The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
I help people every day to improve their health. Sometimes they've had lifelong issues or not fully recovered after a stressful event. The doctors have often run out of ideas. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show with me, Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that helps people with cancer understand and access integrative medicine. Integrative medicine is a broad church, very broad in fact. It's actually notable for its inclusivity when it comes to accommodating a wide range of approaches. Today, our unusual topic is a first for this show. We're going to be exploring immersion in nature as a therapy. It's relatively new to the UK, but is gaining credibility as a useful approach for many problems, mental, physical, and emotional. To explore the territory, I shall be talking to Amy Trotter. I know Amy as she was once a central figure in the administration of Yes to Life, but she went on to train in mental health nursing and has become something of an expert in the field of eco-psychology. I'm talking to Amy over the phone at her home in Bristol. Hi Amy, it's lovely to have the chance to talk to you today and to have you on the Yes to Life show.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
So today we're talking about the relationship between our health and the natural environment. It's not something that's been given much consideration in Western healthcare until pretty recently, but in various forms, nature-based therapies are becoming increasingly prescribable by doctors. Now, critics would say this isn't really medicine and the NHS shouldn't waste money on it and they should stick to proper drugs, operations, that kind of thing. So what would you say to them?
I think if you look at nature and its role within wellbeing, right back to the start, if you look at the fact that a lot of hospitals were based within natural settings, a lot of the mental health institutions, which have a lot of issues around them, obviously, but they were set in nature for a reason. I think it fundamentally is accepted by people on some level that being in nature is good for you. You know, people used to be prescribed, doctors say go for a holiday, go to the beach, get the air.
Yeah.
And it's only very recently, actually, within Western medicine that we've moved away from that. And I think that in part is due to the real need for evidence-based therapy. There was a lot of stuff going on that wasn't okay. And so healthcare swung from being very intuitive right the other way to being actually everything needs to have randomised controlled trials, needs to be peer-reviewed, which, you know, I'm a nurse, all my practice needs to be evidence-based. And so I do take it really seriously. But now the idea that nature-based therapy, even being in nature, isn't a medicine, isn't a prescribable medicine due to not having evidence, just isn't the case. 6 years ago when I was doing my dissertation, it was real struggle to find any kind of evidence that I could write about and, you know, it'd be accepted. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot in Japan with forest bathing, which is just coming over here. There was Scandinavia, was kind of heating up there. But within the UK, there really wasn't anything in what they'd call the proper scientific community.
Mm.
But now, there was a fantastic report in 2016 by Natural England, basically commissioned a report looking at nature-based therapies. And it's fantastic because it's got all of the studies that are currently, like in the last 6 years, have happened. Nature can be prescribed because it's intuitively, we know it's good for us. There's scientific evidence to show that actually it can be as good as things like CBT, antidepressants, you know, depending on what type of therapy it is. And actually, I think that there's a big acceptance coming within the UK, especially Canada, even the United States to a certain extent, with wilderness therapy, that this should be part of the package. It should be one of the things that's offered or promoted.
Okay, well, good. So this is a bit of a first for the show. We've never really focused on nature and health in the way we're going to today. Can you just tell us briefly about yourself, your background, your training, and what made you decide to go in this direction?
Of course. I mean, when we're thinking about nature, it's worth saying that I grew up in London and I was absolutely terrified of cows. I was terrified of open spaces. So it wasn't a natural fit for me as a teenager. I think I would have laughed in the face and said I'd end up where I am today. But then I think partly through my partner, getting involved with bushcraft, festivals, actually, I think introduced quite a lot of people to enjoying being outside.
Mm-hmm.
Gradually, the penny dropped that I felt better when I was outside than when I was inside.
Mm.
Simple as that.
Right.
I think professionally, I'm a nurse. I'm a mental health nurse. And I specialise in working with within CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, and I work within the defending team at the moment. And I would love to get to do more of this stuff with the young people, but even just today, I went with a young person to a park to have our session, and I think I weave it into any work I'm doing with a person in some way.
Hmm, right.
I was lucky enough to do the year-long eco-psychology course with Phelan Training, which was lovely, and really kind of got to the nitty-gritty of connection with nature. I did a day course in forest bathing, which I think will come be massive in the UK.
Okay. So there have been a lot of warnings in the news recently about the effects on our children of living in an increasingly virtual world. Many kids nowadays have pretty much zero contact with nature. So I'm assuming that you would agree with me that I think it's a bit of a health time bomb I'm facing here. I'd like to know how you predict this is going to play out in the lifetime of a young person who's growing up now in a virtual world.
I think in terms of this, there was a couple of issues there. I think the virtual world is inherently quite damaging. I think there are positives to it in terms of engagement with positive causes, in terms of people being able to communicate with people across the globe and getting involved with stuff they're really, really passionate about.
Yeah.
But equally, I think there's a loss of communication. I find young people really sometimes struggle with face-to-face communication. Quite often we'll write stuff down or text them in the session. Because that's just not part of the norm anymore. Young people sit side by side texting each other.
Amazing.
I think with the blue light from phones is well known to disrupt sleep, and there's so many issues to do with technology. But I have seen it kind of take people outside. I remember there was the Pokemon craze where people were going out and collecting Pokemon, and sometimes that was probably the only time that young person was outside.
Right.
So I'm kind of on the fence. I'm on the fence with it, really.
Right.
Well, that was, can be a force for good, but it also can be really damaging.
That was an example of a technology company addressing one of the criticisms of the platform. I mean, it's a bit like the things where they actually reckon that people who played computer games just spent the whole time on the sofa, so they invented ones where you actually had to stand up and do stuff, jump around. So,
and yet people are getting run over in the road.
Right, busy looking at their phone. So, you know, given the long term, though, I mean, if these kids are spending all their youth, their teenage life, looking at screens, preferring a kind of virtual environment to the real one, what do you think is going to happen to them in the long term? How do you think it's going to affect them?
I think, in so many ways. If you think about their physical health, their lack of vitamin D, we're seeing people with severe lack of vitamin D in a way we didn't even 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So obesity, not getting outside, not walking to places. Anxiety is massively increased in young people. Depression. So many things. And there's a disconnect from feeling part of something. When you realise that, I mean, fundamentally humans are part of nature. It's not something that's separate to us.
Mm.
We've only been living inside for the last, what, a couple of thousand years. I mean, so before that, we were animals. But we are fundamentally animals that have a need to interact with the world around us. And the more we're separated from it, the more we're separated from life cycles. So noticing seasons, noticing time pass, the ritual of being outside. I don't think I noticed, I didn't know that daffodils came out in spring till I was probably in my 20s.
Right.
And these little joyful moments that you get, I think they're just going to miss out on all of that. And language.
Hmm.
There's, I think it's something like 60 natural words being dropped from the young people's dictionary.
Yes, just because they don't use them.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because there have been quite a few statistics arrived recently which have shown that whereas all the kind of things you'd think were normal pointers to how long somebody lives, you know, i.e. whether they smoke, whether they drink, whether they're a bit, all those kind of things. Well, they do have an effect, but they don't have as much effect as their social connections, their intimate partnerships, this kind of thing, which are much more of the human level. And I assume that, I don't know if it's been looked into, but of course, relationship to nature must be up there with them, I imagine.
Living around nature can make you live longer.
How about that?
According to an article I just saw, yeah.
Hmm.
I think a lot of social planners, town planners, are taking it into account now.
Mm.
There is a big movement towards it. But again, it's money.
Yes, it is.
It takes money in planning and consensus.
All right. Well, look, we've talked about the fact that the well-being benefits that come from being in nature, they're both physical and mental. I'd like to break it apart now a bit more. Obviously, you work in the field of mental health, so you must be acutely aware of how it affects that area. But I don't know if you're able to tell us about that, but maybe also what you can tell us about how it affects people physically as well.
One of the studies I absolutely loved when I was doing meditation was the fact that after an operation, simply having a view of nature from your window can increase your healing time.
Really?
Physical healing time.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a fundamental...
Right.
I couldn't believe it wasn't more widely shared.
Yeah. So just having a window onto nature, that does it.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then I guess if you look at physical and mental health together... Serotonin, the release of there are stress hormones that get released, and they study people that were walking down the road in the city compared to walking down a country path.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones in the city have much higher stress hormones, which not only affects your mental health, but affects your ability to heal, it affects your fight-flight response, so you're less able to... Yeah, I guess heal, progress, grow, all of these things.
Hmm.
As I said before, the vitamin D. Vitamin D is very, very good for you. Even getting outside for 10, 15 minutes a day.
Yes.
Loads of people take supplements now, which is fine. But, you know, we weren't designed to be indoors all day. We were designed to be outside.
Mm-hmm.
And our physical bodies were designed to take in vitamin D via the sun, which is why it's so hard to take in through supplements.
So people who are walking down the street then are basically in kind of defensive mode. They're kind of stressed. They're worried at some level. There's a lot of things to be concerned about for their safety or whatever, from other people or from cars or whatever. And that is a contrast with being very relaxed in nature.
No, nature isn't always relaxing. I mean, well, true, and that is the least relaxing place I've ever been. I think in this country you kind of take it for granted that we've got a very tame nature. It's still going to be dangerous.
Yes, well, I imagine so. I mean, the stress levels must go up at times, but the thing you were describing, though, is somebody walking down a stress-free country path. Is that right? Yeah.
Well, I think if you're in nature, the stresses are real. If you're walking down the city,
yeah,
a city path, there's so much going on for your brain to take in. If you think about us fundamentally as animals,
yeah,
we're designed to go into fight-flight mode. That's what stress is about. It's functional.
Yes.
But we don't really get the stress and the release in our current lives. So if you're walking down the road, you're stressed, there's lots and lots going on. It's different to being aware of an animal that could hurt you, and then the animal going, there's a natural progression, and it's real fear and it's real danger, whereas quite often the dangers we face day to day are social, there's anxiety, it's fear of deadlines, which, you know, they're very real and they do go, but physically they're different. I don't know, I'm guessing why the results were different, we can't know.
Anyway, very interesting. Okay, so before the show you introduced a word that I definitely don't use every day, biophilia, which I'd heard it before but I had to look it up. Can you explain?
Sure. Biophilia is it's a term coined by Wilson, you know, I think it's the mid-1980s, I believe, and so he basically pointed out the fact, like we were saying, that we are animals and it is intrinsic and fundamental that we have connection with the world around us. And so he was talking about the natural sense of calm we get when we can see the horizon, because that was our the environments that were naturally safer for us if we could see what was going on. And so he was saying that actually our move towards living inside in these different areas is what's going to cause a lot of stress.
Interesting, that thing about the horizon. I know what you mean. It's very appealing, the horizon, for some reason, isn't it?
Space and...
Yeah.
Yeah, safety.
Yeah.
And bigger picture, all of it.
Yeah. So there's different kinds of nature. There's, on the one hand, you've got Regent's Park. It's a very beautiful example of humans using and sort of creating a result with nature. And being there, I think it exposes people to lots of benefits, hence why they've become so popular, the whole idea of building parks in cities. But then you've got the wilds of Scotland. It's a very different sort of nature, and there's a lot less about it that's been... created by human beings, and I suspect a very different effect on us. Do you want to say a little bit more about the contrast between these two?
Yeah, of course. I think everybody needs a different type of nature. If I'd been taken to the Scottish Highlands at 15, it would not have been a pleasant experience. I think that's really key in thinking about what type of nature people should go for, or work their way up to. I think within a city you need, it's a day-to-day interaction with nature. You don't need to get out to the middle of nowhere in order to benefit from it. You can see it change day by day. You can, like I say, notice the daffodils when they come up. They're quite often social places. Loads of really beautiful reasons why parks are needed. And there's a lump in the city as well. Now, if you live near a park, your mental well-being is going to be much higher. But then if you go to the wilds of Scotland, there's... I think it can reconnect you to a deeper part of your own nature. So, because it is wilder, because it is a little bit more dangerous, there is more of a sense of interaction rather than just observing. If you're camping in the middle of a forest, you feel the cold, you feel the rain. I'm not saying everyone should go and do it, But, well, I do think everyone should go through that, actually. You know, maybe work your way up.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I think that there's something, it's something about the danger and the vastness of it.
Yes.
And the feeling quite small in comparison, but also feeling part of something.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. So there's a kind of sliding scale here of wildness, if you like, from the relatively tame, the back garden, out to the wilderness, which you feel there are advantages in moving in the direction of the wilderness.
Yeah. I think that is, I'm not going to say it is for everybody. I think connection with nature is so personal, and there is nothing wrong with just enjoying the park and your garden. But then for some people that isn't, if you've grown up in the countryside, a park might not be as restorative
right.
as you need.
Right.
You might need the wilds of Scotland.
Interesting. All right, so human progress, it's tended to mean more predictable comfort and less uncontrolled interaction with the environment, the kind of stuff you were just talking about. So we got the central heating, the air conditioning, the instant gratification of all sorts. So you just click on our mouse and we get the thing delivered painlessly and easily. So I think the picture of a luxury car with its ability to swish you along down the road at 70 miles an hour, you're warm, you're comfortable, the soothing music is washing over you. But actually the reality could be that you're just on the point of dying because it's icy fog outside and you're going too fast, you know. So these are all kind of ways that create a cushion between ourselves and the reality of nature. So whereas on the one hand you can't blame us for equating progress with comfort, I mean, you know, who wants to go back to always being cold, for example? But what can we do to avoid losing touch with nature through this process and therefore with what you are describing as our true nature?
So I love being warm. I've really got that, and I've never had one before. Waking up in the morning to a warm house is amazing.
You love that.
I'm not about to live in the woods.
Right.
But there are so many different ways you can incorporate it, from having house plants that you notice grow and change for the year, to walking for 10 minutes maybe through a park and just seeing the same tree each day.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of social allotments, like community allotments you can get involved with. I think the interaction is really key for me personally. I think a lot of the, it's great to look at something through a window, like you said, you need to do it that way, that can be really, really beneficial. But there is something to be said for having interaction in the same way with people. It's great to be around people, but sometimes chatting is quite good.
Right.
Exercise I do with people really, really often, with teenagers in particular, is literally being on one side of the door inside, closing your eyes and taking 5 or 10 breaths, and stepping outside, taking 5 or 10 breaths and just noting the difference in quality.
Okay.
So noting the difference in the way it makes you feel.
Yeah.
And then you can really, you know, for everyone it's going to be different. Some people it won't have any effect, some people have a massive effect. But just noticing when you're outside is the start. Maybe aiming to increase the amount of time you're outside. Getting involved in gardening groups, going on conservation holidays, learning what the names of the birds are, right through to eco psychology, going right into the depths of your connection with nature with a trained therapist, or forest bathing where you immerse yourself in nature.
So yeah, the show's all about cancer, so I always want to bring it round to looking at how this relates to cancer particularly. So serious illnesses tend to bring up a level of fear that can generally be avoided at other times, sort of deep existential fear. Our basic trust in life or lack of it gets exposed, bringing the fear of death, fear of others, all these really fundamental things to the surface. So Our lack of acceptance of things just the way they are, including our inevitable death at some point, of course, becomes obvious. So can you say a little bit about the fundamental connections between these kind of fears and our relationship to nature?
Yes, that's a really, really good point. I think it's in Western societies in particular, we've been so separated from death. It's hidden away. We don't see, the only dead person I've seen is my strange DNA. We're not exposed to it. People don't talk about it. Mm. We don't do the wailing or the mourning. So it's a process that is hidden. Even if you look at the food we eat, it's a lot of people I know won't eat food with bones in it because it reminds them that the animal was once alive.
Right.
I think connecting with nature means connecting with the cycles, of life and death, and the acceptance—not the acceptance, but the acknowledgement that their life is a cycle. And so, I think from the start, having as a culture, if we were more connected to nature, I think that would be more embedded. I think for people facing those really, really difficult times, those difficult circumstances, I'm not saying nature is the cure-all, but I know through reading poets, through reading prose, Clive James is classic. He's written some beautiful poetry about noticing his garden in the year that he believed he was going to die.
All right.
And noticing that the tree in his garden, he was thinking about the fact he wouldn't see it the next year. And really wanting to experience every bit of it. It's spring, it's summer, it's autumn. Because he thought it would be the last time. And I think everything in nature does face death at some point. And from speaking to people, there can be a sense of unity with the world, with the process.
Right.
So it's a difficult connection.
It is, but it's you're right. Of course, we don't see human death particularly, but of course we do see the death of all sorts of other things around us all the time, and we quite readily accept that as part of life. It is when it applies to us that it starts to get difficult, doesn't it?
But do you think we really do notice the death of other stuff around us?
We got the seasons, okay? So in plants, we do. We accept all the cycles of the plants and all the rest of it. Animals, if they're very close to us, no, it's very difficult if we're actually attached to them at all. They're almost like people. But the more distance they get in that kind of way, the more people accept it. Not everybody does, of course. There's a strong movement against killing animals deliberately for food. But there are dead animals all around us. The road is, you never go far down the road without seeing one. So it is part of our lives.
Mm. Absolutely, it's part of our lives. But I've seen the disgust in people when they've had to pick up a dead animal to move it.
Aha, uh-huh, yes.
And that automatic, oh, don't want to touch that, don't want to be part of that.
Yes.
I don't want to interact with that.
Mm. No, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the conclusion from this is that nature can be helpful to you at a time of facing the kind of deep fear that comes up with something like cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm at the Penny Ball Centre in Bristol, just a wonderful work around it.
Okay.
And obviously there are lots of practitioners around the UK who can support people in that position.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's what I want to ask you a bit about next. Yes, I'm interested to know, well, what do people do? Say it's not just a case for them of wandering out the back into the forest, you know, they're thinking, well, here I am in wherever it is, you know, and what do I actually do about this? I've decided it's an interesting idea I want to explore. Well, where do they go for help, and what is there out there for them?
There is a lot of different resources. I think in terms of mental health, EcoMinds, which is a report by Mind that has lots of ideas on it. Conservation Volunteers is great. Then in terms of that, with nature-based therapies, they're kind of a bit unregulated at the moment and a bit disjointed.
Right.
I think if you're looking for a nature-based therapy, it could be called ecotherapy, green care, nature-based therapies, eco-psychology, and they're all a little bit different, but okay. There's not a unified language.
No.
But I think some of the key really supportive practices, like forest bathing, which is coming over to this country from Japan, very quickly.
Do you want to just describe what forest bathing is?
Yeah, so forest bathing is going out into the woods or into a tent of the woods in a structured way with a guide and connecting with the woods in using the senses, so through sight, sound, scent. So they tend to go to pine forests, taste, smell, and touch.
Right.
So it's a facilitated way of being in a forest. Go in a group.
Yeah.
It can be a day, it can be a couple of hours, and if you type forest bathing into Google UK, then it will come up. There's a list of practitioners throughout the UK, the UK that do it.
Right. Are there literally plenty of them?
Yeah, it's growing. There aren't masses, but it is growing.
Okay.
It's a growing body.
All right. So what other kinds are people looking at?
So there's social and therapeutic horticulture. We go out with a horticultural therapist who's trained. And you do gardening with therapy combined. That can be beautiful. There's a lovely centre in London that does it with people experiencing PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be applied to, obviously, it can be applied to the trauma of diagnosis.
Yes.
Of cancer or any terminal illness or life-threatening illness.
So what does that kind of horticulture look like? What are you doing that makes it any different from any other kind?
So you're going out, doing a bit of gardening, which is really good. But then you've got a therapist alongside you that can explore what it's bringing up in you. So what the emotions behind it are.
I see.
And can contain that.
Mm.
There are NHS-funded horticultural therapists, I believe.
There are. Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, and anything else?
So there's wellness nature retreats, and a lot of places in the UK are offering these now, where you can go and you can camp, or you can glamp, which is nicer, because you get the luxury of the woodburner.
Yeah.
Or, and there are people there that can support you through it. Foraging, you know, even going out with your local foraging expert, make sure the person who's taking you knows what they're doing.
All right.
But if it's local to you, if it's in a park, then you get to know the local park and what it can offer. And just getting out there.
So that's foraging for food, basically, finding a food that just grows naturally around and about. And as you say, it's important to get somebody who knows what they're doing so you don't pick the wrong thing.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay, well, I imagine that something like a camping retreat for somebody who'd never done such a thing could be quite a watershed moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a leap of faith, and it's an immersion in an environment that is so connected to you, but we are so disconnected from.
Mm.
I think even when I was helping at a bushcraft school when I was in my early 20s, and the emotional journey that people went, it wasn't a therapeutic intervention at all. It was teaching firefighting, knife skills, shelter building, but the amount of people that came, and you could see a shift in them.
Mm.
And actually, that's a big when you get back into your car, you're back in the real world, you're going back on the motorway and kind of preparing people for going back to the real world.
Yeah.
Because it was such a powerful experience.
A real re- retreat.
Going back into it.
Interesting the way the language, though, because in fact they might have been leaving the real world to go back to the pretend one that we live in most of the time.
Very good point. Because I've been living in a city for too long.
It's interesting, isn't it, that such simple pursuits should have such an effect on people, really. You wouldn't expect it. It's quite a surprise, really, in many ways.
When you think about mindfulness and, the focus on the fundamentals of fire, eating, shelter, survival, feeling that you have a place and you are in control of yourself and you have a function within, you're strong, you can survive, really. It's big. It's not just lighting a couple of fires.
I see it. And also, I mean, talking of mindfulness, I was very immediately put in mind of a sort of meditation. When you started talking about forest bathing and what it is, I kind of imagined a kind of meditative state in a forest.
Mindfulness in forests, or not even forests, just in parks, is one of my favourite things. Just noticing what's around you. But particularly with forest bathing, I think the sensory aspect of it can really hone your attention in. And the process of it as well, being part of a group that's going through a journey together.
Yes.
It's really powerful.
That's, I can see, as an advantage, actually, yes, doing it with other people, particularly if they're, in some similar situation to you. Do you know of any that are actually designed or for people with cancer?
No, I don't, but I will find out.
Okay.
And I'll let you know. I'll have it asked around.
It'll be interesting to know that. Yeah. Okay.
And if there isn't, there should be.
Right. Okay. It could be your calling. Very good. Look, we're coming to the end. Just... I wondered if you thinking of the fact that a significant proportion of the people who listen to the show are people with cancer, is there a way you'd like to sort of sum up what you think all this immersion in nature has on offer for them?
So I think people going through that really difficult experience, life-changing experience, nature has the potential not only to help support some of the physical well-being aspects of healing. I think in terms of feeling restored, reduction in anxiety, a sense of place in the world, which I think quite often if you're being put on this conveyor belt of cancer treatment, it can be very, very disempowering. But to feel in control of yourself and to feel part of something big can be really kind of counter to that. And when someone very close to me had cancer and they were going through an operation, I was going to a park and just melting into the grass because it was a sunny day and the world is there and the world is supportive, like nature is supportive.
Yes.
And just knowing no matter what happened, there is life and there is life after operations. And you can still, even after you've had a really difficult operation, you can go outside and feel the warmth of the sun on your face. You can sense that. And I guess even if it's just going outside for 5 minutes when you're at the hospital, just taking a break from the setting and just taking a couple of deep breaths in when you're outside rather than the air conditioned air inside. I hope it would be helpful.
Well, it's very interesting because we were talking about the kind of existential fear that's around something like cancer, and you were describing there really strengthening your connection to life and the world about you by being out there and amongst it.
Absolutely. I would say life is there until the very last moment. You can always connect to life.
Right. All right. Thank you for that. Well, on that note, we'll say goodbye. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today and to explore this unusual topic for the first time on this show. It's been really interesting, Amy. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Lovely talking to you.
Medicine that's just a breath of fresh air. I hope some of you listening will want to follow up on some of Amy's suggestions, particularly if you're a city dweller. For links to material relating to the interview, go to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the show logo on the homepage. I'd like to tell you about an event that's coming up in the Yes to Life calendar. It's on April the 27th, and it's a Cancer Wellness Day, which is at the Manchester Art Gallery. Visit the Yes to Life website, again that's yestolife.org.uk, and click events in the left hand sidebar, or look on the Yes to Life Facebook page in order to find full information or book tickets. Thanks very much for joining me for today's show. I hope you'll be able to listen again next week. Goodbye. Thank you.